What I'm about to read to you comes from the Connecticut Institute for Resilience and Climate Adaptation. It reads, sea level change is caused by a number of factors, but since the late 19th century, ocean warming and ice sheet loss due to global warming have contributed significantly to global sea level rise. Along the East Coast, including Connecticut, sea level rise rates are more rapid than the global average rate because of subsidence or sinking of the coastline. Oh, well, welcome. We're glad you're part of the full story for now. We're on WSHU and online at WSHU.org. I'm Ron Ropiak. Look, it seems every time we turn around nowadays, there's another report that scares us. But it's that time of the year when we come out of our caves and we rediscover the great outdoors, and it becomes more apparent our world is changing and changing quickly. Where you can really see it is when you head to the shorelines. And that's our discussion today. How is the coastline changing? Are the beaches we love going to survive? Will they need to be altered, protected? We have lots and lots of questions. I'm guessing you do too. You can send them to us by email. We're at tfs@wshu.org, or find us on Twitter at FullStoryWSHU, and we're also on Facebook at The Full Story. We're always looking for smart people who can answer our questions. Today we have a bunch of them. To start our show, we call upon Alex Felsen, Deputy Executive Director and Director of Design for Resilience at the Connecticut Institute for Resilience and Climate Adaptation, and Associate Research Scientist, Marine Sciences University of Connecticut. Welcome, Professor Felsen. How are you? And I should mention, you're joining us on Skype.
Yes, I am. Thank you very much. I'm doing well.
I know you look in many, many aspects of this monumental, and this is a life-changing issue. But can I ask you to focus in on what the rising waters mean for our beaches? Are they in danger?
Okay, well, the area, beaches are typically in low-lying areas along the coast of Connecticut, and low-lying areas and floodplains are areas that are going through changes with sea level rise. There are also areas that we see have been hit in the past by hurricanes and nor'easters and other events. So it's not something that's necessarily new in terms of our experience of damage or impact. And beaches are dynamic, so they're eroding and accumulating over time, regardless of human impact.
So when you say they're dynamic and they're changing over time, some have mentioned to me, look, isn't this being a bit exaggerated? Isn't this what they do anyway? The sand comes in, the sand goes out, it erodes, it builds back up. This is nature.
Yeah, I think that is one way of looking at it. I think the challenge that we face is that we've built houses, roads, utilities, and infrastructure in areas that face flood risk. And we've constricted our options in terms of recreational areas, in terms of the land uses upland of those. And we like to be on the water, and we enjoy, recreation along the edge of the coastline.
Mm. So it almost sounds as if you're saying, look, if we didn't put all these developments by the water, maybe it wouldn't be that big of a deal because, this is just the way it is.
Exactly.
Okay. These changes that they're talking about, sea level rising, water is heating up. I think we're seeing some of them now, right? But are they going to accelerate sometime in the future?
Well, it's hard to predict exactly, but we have developed at Circa with Jim O'Donnell, the executive director, an anticipated sea level rise by 2050 of as much as 50 centimeters. And that was done through an analysis of existing modeling efforts as well as data from Long Island Sound. So it's a fairly reliable estimate of predicted sea level rise conditions. As you move further into 2100, the uncertainty increases, and so the range of potential impact is it gets wider, so it's harder to predict.
Are you talking about all the way from Greenwich all the way to the other side of the state in Connecticut?
Yeah, the entire coast of Connecticut, as well as around the world, faces sea level rise impacts. There are variations between the eastern and the western coast of Connecticut, which is an interesting phenomenon that has impacts on things like the elevation, the recommended municipal elevation of housing above base flood elevations. Mm-hmm. If you look on the eastern portion of the coast versus the western portion, there's a difference across them, which I think is an interesting gradient, suggesting that municipalities are starting to recognize the flood risk.
Just out of curiosity, how much of a change is there between East and West?
Well, it's a fairly small level of change, but the impact has over time with wave action and other factors, it starts to accumulate. So it's only inches, I believe.
Okay. Now, you were saying that the change is 50 centimeters, I believe you said, by 2050?
So that's a high rank. So it's as much as 50. It's probably less. We basically... Jim O'Donnell worked out some estimates based on the research analysis that Circa has been doing on Long Island Sound, for multiple decades, and looking at modeling predictions. And basically, we wanted to develop a planning level, an estimate that could be used by engineers and town planners to make smart choices about finished floor elevations.
Hmm. Okay, now let's say even if by some miracle we all came together and decided to do the right thing for the sake of humanity, would that be too late to stop the changes that you're currently talking about?
Well, it is kind of a moving freight train, so I do think it's important to think about, to take action as soon as we can, because it's going to have an impact, in the future. It's going to be hard to change. It's going to be hard to divert the some of the levels of impact that we've already started, based on the amount of action and activity that humans have made. So there's no way around sea level rise, which is going to have some impact on coastal communities. The Connecticut is somewhat unique because it has both ridgelines and low-lying areas along the coast, partly based on the historic geology and the glacial history of the state. So there are pockets that are low-lying that face flood risk, and then there is also high ground along the coast. So it creates more of a heterogeneous condition, which Circa in the state is working with as an asset for Connecticut to be strategic about how to develop further and also how to tinker with areas with low-lying areas.
Hmm. Professor, can we talk about practical matters? Because I know that part of your job is you try to get the authorities to work together, right, to plan for the future?
Absolutely.
But how do you do that when there's no central form of government in the counties and sometimes, the kids don't play well together in the sandbox?
That's a good analogy. I would say that, first of all, you have to recognize from the homeowner to the municipal manager to the state representative, you have to realize that there are multiple layers of decision making and options in terms of action. So the way that, the municipal managers are a key representative and play a key role in thinking about solutions. I guess the way that we've been pushing is to think about a combination of innovative strategies that are also practical. So combining some innovative thinking with practical solutions. So the idea of everyone retreating is not something that's going to happen, and it's not really a practical option. But the notion of identifying low-lying properties and that don't have, that don't have an easy egress that's going to require investment from the municipality in terms of utilities and services, it's useful to start to look at the overall costs of what it would take to maintain, let's say, a beachfront community that has all, that would put a demand on the municipality in terms of all the other services, versus investing in an area where it floods along a road, but it services, 100 plus houses that are all on high ground.
Interesting, because you're saying, look, because I've read a few articles where some have advocated that it should stop, construction should stop, the homes in the future, many of them, as you, I think you said, a retreat, just move them further inland. But from a practical standpoint, that's not going to happen, right?
No, and I don't think it needs to happen. There are certain areas all across the country where I think retreat is potentially the best option, partly because you get coastal plains that are flat and have limited elevation change, and so you get ubiquitous flooding. In Connecticut, that's not the case. In Connecticut, you have high ground in areas where there's pockets of risk. So really, it's a question of thinking about, raising homes, developing alternative egress routes that provide access to those homes, thinking about alternative utility investment strategies, creating some areas where where you decide that it doesn't make sense to invest, or there's, like, for example, no road raising strategies or other approaches, or transitions after one or two generations of ownership, strategies that allow for some adaptation. But at the same time, we all recognize our love of being on the water and the value of property along the water and the importance of that access. And so, we're not looking for retreat. We're looking for effective adaptation solutions. And in some ways, I think we can also, through that adaptation, we can potentially increase public access to the coast, which is something that I think that would be of interest to many in Connecticut.
Professor, with the 30 seconds that we have left, are the authorities paying enough attention to this at the moment?
That's a good question. The municipalities are very interested in beach areas. I think that it's a tough situation because investing in beaches may not be the smartest first choice given the range of risks that municipalities face, but it is an area that the public really supports. So I think using beach investment strategies to inform and educate municipalities about flood risk and how to adapt in the long term, I think, is one way forward.
Alex Felsen, Deputy Executive Director and Director of Design for Resilience at the Connecticut Institute for Resilience and Climate Adaptation, and Associate Research Scientist, Marine Sciences, University of Connecticut. Professor Felsen, thank you. We appreciate your time today. Please come back with us in the future.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. This is The Full Story on WSHU. I'm Ron Ropiak. Today we're talking about the beaches. It's almost summertime, I know. Looking out the window, it doesn't seem like it, but it's almost here. We'll take a short break. We'll be right back. It's The Full Story on WSHU. We always appreciate your comments and your thoughts, and you can email them to us at tfs@wshu.org. Or if you're a Twitter user, we're at FullStoryWSHU. Our conversation today is spring and summer related. It's about the beaches in our region. Yesterday, we talked about how to get onto them. Today, we're talking about what they're going to look like in a few years in light of global warming and climate change. I'd like to welcome two more guests to our program. Professor Juliana Barrett is an Associate Extension Educator with the Connecticut Sea Grant Program. Professor Barrett is an ecologist, and she's involved in climate adaptation with communities throughout Connecticut. And Professor Henry Bokanyevich. He is Professor of Oceanography at Stony Brook University School of Marine and Atmospheric Sciences. Professor Barrett, Professor Bokanyevich, welcome. It's good to have you both with us.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ron. Glad to be here.
Professor Barrett, can I start with you, please? You're actively involved with climate adaptation. Is Connecticut ready for the changes I hear will be happening faster and faster?
It's a great question, and I think communities are recognizing that there are definitely issues, especially after Irene and Sandy, and many different groups are trying to prepare, but you have to remember that we have 87 miles of beach along the Connecticut shoreline, and some of it's owned by the state, some by towns, some by private beach associations, and some by NGOs like the Nature Conservancy, Land Trust, Audubon, for example. And I think everybody is realizing that we need to at least do some management planning, and are working toward that.
In our first segment, I used the analogy of trying to get the kids to play together properly in the sandbox. Is that basically what you're saying, to get all these disparate groups together and say, look, this is something we need to tackle together?
Well, yes. And I have a great story to share, and that is a private beach association down in Madison started, they contacted me because they wanted to work on a management plan. And they, in turn, contacted neighboring beach associations and said, hey, look, we're doing this. You know, maybe we can work together. And you've got three beach associations that are all along the shoreline that are working together to develop at least similar goals and moving forward. So I think that's a wonderful example of how we actually can all play together in the sandbox.
Professor Bokunyevich, how much should homeowners and beachgoers be concerned about sea level rise? Is it something that we're all going to notice this summer?
Well, you probably won't notice it all that much. Sea level is rising, and it certainly doesn't make things any better. But in the day-to-day life, we really are looking at the next storm as the big concern, and need to be preparing for that more than looking in the longer term at this point.
So it's keeping an eye on the radar nowadays, huh? Because a lot of the storms that we're experiencing nowadays, at least to me, they are quite severe. And I think back to Sandy, what was it, 2012? And I shake my head. When storms like that hit, does the beach get a chance to actually fix itself? Does nature do what nature does?
Well, it depends on where you are and the sequence of events. But in time, yes, the beaches do tend to repair themselves as long as there's an adequate supply of sand. But like I said, as sea level rises, that gets a little bit harder and a little bit harder. And the next storm can take a longer period to recover.
Huh. Professor Barrett, are we overreacting? I mean, erosion is natural, right? Sand comes in, sand goes out. Sometimes it goes more to another part of the beach. Isn't this just nature at work?
Not completely, I think, because we've put up so many structures along our shoreline that have an impact on the flow of sediment and the movement of sediment. And also, much of the sand for our beaches comes from the glacier, what was left by the glacier and these sandy deposits along the Connecticut shoreline. And so there's some beaches that have room to roll landward, which is what they do naturally. But because we've developed the shoreline, right, they can roll backward until they hit the railroad tracks or a road or some other form of infrastructure.
And then that's it. Huh? I'm sorry, Professor Bokunyevich, it sounded like you wanted to jump in.
No, I was just hanging on here.
Can I ask you a basic question? When the beach moves, where does it move to? Does it go west? Does it go east?
Well, on Long Island, one thing to recognize is there's a big difference between the Connecticut coast and the Long Island coast. If you drew a line kind of down the middle of Long Island Sound, then going north of that, the coastline is very rocky. And this gives you limited opportunity for either supplies of sand or migration of sand, as Dr. Barrett was saying. On the south coast of Long Island, as you go south of that line, the shoreline looks very much like it does all the way down to the tip of Florida. There's lots of sand in the system, and the beaches are very well developed all the way down. In that case, it's not a matter of whether you're going to have a beach after a storm, but where it's going to be. Our big problems come not with actually losing beaches, having them disappear altogether, but not having the sand be in the places that we want it to be.
I assume that this must be especially upsetting for homeowners because those who are living nearby, I mean, that sand is that barrier that protects them, right?
Oh, yes, absolutely. And that's what I was saying before. The biggest concern is the next storm because that will be doing the damage. So that while we do have to be concerned about rising sea levels and the fact that these issues are not going to just get any better, the real concern is what to do when the next hurricane comes through.
Professor Barrett, what if you live high up? I mean, you're up on the bluff, well above the beach. Are you safe? Are you okay there?
Not necessarily. If you're up on a bluff, it could depend how close you are to the edge of that bluff, because bluffs are by nature an eroding structure. And so there can be ways to stabilize a bluff. And depending on where you are, you know, certainly in a storm, you can still sustain plenty of wind damage.
And that bluff, from what I understand, that bluff is also there to provide some sand to the beach, right? But at the meantime, you don't want to lose too much. You don't want to gain too much. It seems like a balancing act all the time.
Very much so. You're absolutely right. Those bluffs provide the sediment as they erode. And we have seen many instances throughout New England of lighthouses and homes being moved further landward.
Professor Balkanyevich, how do you balance that? Who gets to decide, by shoring up a bluff or letting some of it come down? Who ultimately makes that decision?
Oh, that's a very good question. It ultimately goes down to the agency, the resource agency that's going to be supplying the permit for any kind of construction for shore protection. But the question is hard to answer. You would like to know how much sand you really have to get to the beach from the bluff erosion and how much you can stop without damaging the beaches. And those are questions I don't think we have good answers to. One of the issues that Dr. Barrett brought up earlier was the fact that we often do about these measures in piecemeal. One homeowner would do A, and another one will do B, and another one will do C, and then the town or the county will do something else entirely. And while that's the modus operandi at the moment, it's a very bad way to proceed. You'd like to look at these things on a regional basis and really decide how much you can afford to lose, how much you really need to protect, and where the balance is.
So, Professor Barrett, I guess I'm slightly confused because I know every town, every municipality, they have their own set of rules and guidelines, and it just seems so, I'm thinking of the word hodgepodge at this point because it's all over the place.
That's very true, but there are certain things that every community, you know, with a beach can do, and that is in terms of the dune systems that are usually associated with the beach, those dune systems, the sand is accreted with the beach grass that grows on those dunes. That's mm-hmm. the native plant. They have very deep root systems, and they really help to trap sand. And so every community, you know, with a beach dune system can make sure that those beaches, the dunes are as healthy as possible by having many groups go out and they plant beach grass in areas where there's pockets, and also by limiting the number of walkways through the dunes because they are very sensitive plants. And so if you only have, you know, one or two walkways as opposed to letting everybody create their own walkway through a dune system, it goes a long way toward protecting that system.
Are beachgoers and are we all becoming aware of this? Because there have been times when I've been to the beach and I've seen people running through the beach grass and through the dunes, and I'm thinking, come on, how do you get the word out?
You know, we have a long way that we could go, and I think a lot of it is people just don't know. And I think by posting information, many communities have, you know, these dunes are under construction. By engaging people in these beach grass plantings and working with students, we bring a lot of students out to do the beach grass plantings and try to educate them about the fragility of the system. And so I think it's all a lot through education.
Professor Balkanyevich, in terms of the bluffs, and because we're talking about planting the grass now for the dunes, and it's just so important, isn't it, for the bluffs to also have vegetation?
Yes and no. There are two main forms of erosion on the bluffs. When it rains very hard and the bluffs are denuded of vegetation, then sand is washed down onto the bluffs from the bluffs onto the beach. And many people think that that is the erosion problem, and in fact, it is one of them. So by planting some natural vegetation on the bluff face, you can slow that down. But very often along the bluff shoreline, as a storm comes, the waves will cross the beach and eat away into the bluff itself, and then you have a collapse of a whole section, vegetation and all. And those are the instances where you start to lose decks and lose houses at the top as a big section of the bluff will fall in all at once. That requires a different sort of protection because you want to stop those undercutting of the bluffs by the waves. But in the same vein, that also stops a supply of sand to the beach.
Professor Barrett, what do your forecasts tell you? Do we have time to make the changes that it appears that we need to make? Is it too late? Is Mother Nature already on a certain course? To be honest, I'm a bit confused nowadays from the different reports.
Well, sea level rise has been happening for centuries, but it's definitely been accelerating. And, you know, all the forecasts are is that it's going to continue to accelerate, at least in the near future. And so I think it's being aware of this issue, being aware of the impact of hardened structures along the shoreline, and that these may protect infrastructure, but they definitely have an impact on our natural ecosystems like beaches and dunes.
I'm sorry to interrupt. You're talking about, yeah, you know, when you go to the beach nowadays and you see those big condos, and not like traditional beach homes, but these huge condos with many people in it and made out of obviously cement and brick and concrete.
No, I'm talking more about groins and rock structures that are put out into the water, often perpendicular to the shoreline.
Ah, okay.
Right. Those sorts of structures that we have there, and seawalls. And so I think we have to make some very difficult decisions about what areas we're going to use these hard structures in terms of the impacts of storms and sea level rise. And then I think we have to continue to do what the state did at Hammonasset Beach, for example, where they've used dredged material from the Housatonic River in 2013 and 2018 to augment the sand that is on the beaches.
So take it out of one area, put it into another.
Yes, that the sand that they used there came from the Army Corps dredging of the Housatonic River. Obviously, with, you know, all the sediment was tested and made sure that it was free of contaminants.
Professor Bokanyevich, what would you like the towns and the municipalities to consider nowadays? What concerns you the most?
Well, like we've mentioned a couple of times, I think one of the biggest concerns is this sort of piecemeal way that we're going at shore protection. There are definitely areas that you want to protect. You need to protect infrastructure. You need to protect the developments that are in place and human safety. But we need to do it in a more comprehensive way, so that what's being done in my neighborhood is not adversely affecting the neighborhood down the beach. And this is this is not really a technical problem at some stage, but more of a social problem of getting people to develop a strategy that takes into account large sections of the shoreline, and then to have the wherewithal to implement it.
And are you hopeful? Are you optimistic that the different towns and groups are working better nowadays?
Yes, I think they are. There's much more discussion in light of the realization of climate change. There's much more discussion of the need for a regional approach, and not just looking at the stretch of beach in front of my own property. It's a difficult thing to do, though, and I'm not sure that we have standard strategies that can be applied in many places to actually solve this problem. It's a work in progress, no doubt.
Professor Barrett, same question, please, with an emphasis on Connecticut.
I would completely agree that we really need to work more comprehensively and not piecemeal. But I do remain optimistic because I'm seeing all these groups that are starting to be aware of these issues and are really trying to take steps to work with neighboring communities and the state and federal agencies to protect our natural resources.
It's interesting, isn't it, how disasters or potential disasters can make some people work together?
Yes, very much so.
Sociology.
Well, you know, interest in shoreline protection and beaches always increases a great deal after a major disaster.
Yeah, yes, it does. And then all of a sudden,
it's good for business.
It's good for you. Don't want to wreck it. It means a lot to our area. Mm-hmm. Professor Henry Bokanyevich, he is a professor of oceanography at Stony Brook University School of Marine and Atmospheric Sciences, and Professor Juliana Barrett, Associate Extension Educator with the Connecticut Sea Grant Program. She's an ecologist and involved in climate adaptation with communities throughout Connecticut. Professor Barrett, Professor Bokanievich, thank you both. I appreciate your time today.
Thank you.
You're welcome, Ron. I enjoyed it.
It's the full story on WSHU. If you would like to join in the conversation, our email is always open for you. You can email us. We're at tfs@wshu.org. Find us on Twitter. We're at FullStoryWSHU, and our voicemail number is 833-CALL-TFS. And for those like me who don't like those, the letters, 833-225-5837. A short break. We'll be right back. It's the full story on WSHU, and just in time for Memorial Day. We're doing a show on what our coastline and shoreline are evolving to, and what we can do to prepare for it. If you live anywhere along the coast, or you know someone who does, you probably keep a pretty close eye on the radar when a storm is blowing through our region. So do these two gentlemen. Joe Michelangelo is the Director of Public Works for Fairfield. He's the one who gets to figure out how to handle the flooding and erosion in that town. And Kevin McAllister is the founder and president of Defend H2O. Defend H2O is a nonprofit. Its members want to protect and restore the environmental quality of groundwater, surface waters, wetlands, and beaches on and around Long Island. Joe, Kevin, welcome. Thanks for coming on today.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ron.
Joe, full disclosure, I lived on the beach in your town quite a number of years ago, and it's absolutely beautiful. But I have to admit that when the storms blow through here, I think about the people who I know who still live there, and I wonder how they're doing. How's the anxiety level nowadays?
I'd say we're preparing ourselves for the next one, and with Storm Sandy was really a awakening in 2012. So, you know, previous to that, I'd say we had deniers to the flooding issue. We didn't have any in such a long time, but since then, so since 2012, we've made quite an effort to and I'll use the word resilient to make Fairfield more resilient to a future storm. There's an awareness that it will happen. It's just a question of when. So I think we're making good steps to prepare for it. And I wouldn't say there's an anxiety level. I think there's more of a realism that it will come, but we'll be better prepared for the next one.
I have to admit, I've never heard that one before. Flooding deniers. I guess anybody could deny anything. And Joe, I was told that you started your job right after Sandy, is that right?
Correct. So I came to Fairfield probably about 6 weeks before Storm Sandy hit. So I've always lived in Connecticut, and before I moved to Fairfield and took this job, I lived in East Haven, grew up in East Haven, lived in Brantford. So I was quite familiar with the Long Island Sound dynamics of flooding, but every town is a little different. So it was on the job baptism by water.
I was going to say, talk about timing, trial by fire, right? Or by water. Yeah. How would you assess the planning procedures now in the town for erosion and for flooding and for the rise of Long Island Sound?
Okay. Well, one thing that Fairfield's had for years, like going back to probably the 50s or 60s, we had a wonderful dike system. So unlike other communities that really cut themselves off from the salt water, Fairfield had a system of dikes and tide gates, which allows the salt water intrusion into our salt marshes, so they're viable, living, breathing things. So the system works fine 365 days a year during the two tide cycles, except when you get a storm. So one of the key things we've done as far as infrastructure point of view is improve our tide gate system. So the tide gate system, you know, the water comes in, and what happened during Sandy, because our dikes were pretty good, we had trouble evacuating the water. Hmm. So we've taken some measures to enlarge them, make them work better so the water is evacuated. So next time, even though we will get flooding, it won't sit in our neighborhood for 3 days. It'll get out faster, return to a sense of normalcy.
Joe, I'm going to ask you to sit tight for just a moment or two because Kevin is being very patient, and I want to spend a few minutes talking with him about Defend H2O. Sure. Kevin, thanks for your patience. Where is Defend H2O based out of?
We're based in Sag Harbor, so the, you know, the east end of Long Island, of course, on the interior. So obviously there's Great Peconic Bay, the Peconic Bay Estuary, that's nearby.
Why was the organization formed? What prompted it?
Well, I think there's been a gap in, I'll say, more direct advocacy, particularly on the water quality issues, the pollution issues, as well as coastal resiliency. We're very concerned about what I believe is a trend in shoreline hardening, and I know that's in response to erosion and sea level rise, of course. But, you know, ultimately, if we don't control the amount of structures, we're going to lose our beaches and impede our wetlands. I know Joe was talking about the importance of these tidal marshes. If we basically wall and pinch them off, the inability to respond and migrate, as would a sandy beach, as the seas are coming up, will ultimately be their demise.
Kevin, is more construction taking place nowadays, or is it being somewhat curtailed by those who may be scared about climate change and global warming?
Oh, I think the trend is clearly more construction. You know, my work takes me certainly around Long Island, the Connecticut shoreline. I'm less familiar with the trends, but the structures are what I call creeping in. Private residences are installing stone revetments, seawalls, bulkheads, geotextiles. So the cumulative impacts of these structures are impeding sand flow. They're arresting shoreline migration. So ultimately, what we're seeing is the loss of the fronting beach. And if, again, this trend continues, you know, we're talking public use implications as well as ecological implications.
I'm going to bring Joe back in a second. But, Kevin, have you spoken with any of these homeowners or developers about your concerns?
Most definitely. I've been very active with public education. So the message is certainly getting out. But you know, when faced with rising seas and eroding shoreline, there's a sense of urgency or panic on the part of property owners that are seeking again the structures as a means of dealing with the erosion trends.
So if Are they basically saying to you, look, I don't want to lose my house. I have to do this.
Yes. And I mean, they're going through proper permitting processes. So there's nothing illegal. But again, I think with respect to protecting the integrity of our natural shorelines, our sandy beaches and wetlands, we've got to get a handle on this because, again, this is occurring at, I think, an increasing trend rate. And, 10, 20, 30 years out, if we, don't get control of the trend, we'll, again, have impacts and losses to these natural areas.
Joe Michelangelo, are you finding this the same type of situation in Fairfield?
And our shoreline area since Sandy has had quite a change in development. I'm not sure when you moved out of there, but what we've seen since Sandy is that more and more of the property owners are elevating their houses above the floodplain. So we're seeing more of that than any ground improvement, so to speak. So when somebody goes to rehab their house, if their old house set at elevation, 8, 9, or 10, now during the regulations, they have to be at first floor elevation 13, 14, and 15. So it's really changed the look of the neighborhood. Mm. And from a economic point of view, I see the houses do have value. They're certainly not giving them away, and the prices are are going up there. So it has, so before, if you had, 20 houses on the street and you stuck up and had a house elevated, you would stick out like a sore thumb. Now it's quite the opposite, which you know, that's the way development is encouraged along the shoreline, where you elevate the property, you get a path of egress in and out, but you're not necessarily putting up revetments or stone walls to stop Long Island Sound, because that's literally impossible.
So the houses are going on, if you will, stilts.
Correct. There's some of them you see on wooden piles like you see in the Carolinas, but for most part they're concrete foundations with piles in the ground, and they set them up so that you could drive under it and use the underneath for car storage or for other storage. And the people, obviously the house is your biggest investment. They've done great jobs of making them look like they've been there for a while and not a reaction to any storm.
Just out of curiosity, and then I'll go back to Kevin. How high up can the homes go?
There are limits on from our planning and zoning perspective. I believe the limit is there's three-story houses up and down the all of our streets there. So I think that approximate elevation about 35 feet up. But once again, if every house is on the same level, you achieve that scale, and it's they are big houses, but I wouldn't say they're all proportionate to each other, which is a good thing from a planning perspective.
Kevin, I have to guess that do you have friends who are realtors or brokers? I mean, what are they telling you? What is this doing to the market?
I'll say I do have friends in the business, and there's. Reticence, I guess. This is difficult information to grasp. Sea level rise, for Connecticut shoreline, they're projecting by 2050 a 20-inch rise. Highest scenario at turn of the century is over 6 feet. When you consider we've experienced roughly a 4-inch rise over the last 40 years, this is in a way exponential. So the changes to shoreline locations are going to be drastic in the next several decades. So in order to respond and ensure that our shorelines remain resilient, we've got to be sure that, again, we're allowing them to migrate. We're not impinging them with again, structures.
Just, it's not funny, but we had a representative from the town of Stratford in Connecticut on our program a while back, and I said, what's one of the things that you're doing for the future? And he goes, I'll tell you what I'm not going to buy property along the shoreline around here. I was just curious with my question to you, are you hearing from anyone who's saying, I'm just going to build a little bit further inland nowadays?
We're talking coastal retreat in certain areas. Downtown Montauk, for instance, there's at least been a movement to recognize that the business district, which is, back off the shore, because of its low elevation, will likely have to be come higher in elevation, as Joe is describing, responding to coastal inundation, which is the groundwater coming up from below, and also recognition that over the long term, some of the waterfront, oceanfront businesses will actually have to relocate, so we'll have to move. This will hold true for a number of areas that are either low-lying or highly vulnerable to erosion trends.
Joe, I know as the Director of Public Works for Fairfield, you're doing the best you can with what the town has to offer. What do you need in terms of support from the state or the federal government?
Well, we've had a lot of projects ongoing since Sandy, and we've been fortunate enough to get some money for construction of projects. Like I mentioned, the tide gate improvements, we're protecting our wastewater treatment plant. We have more plans to move our IT center out of the flood zone, possibly our 911 dispatchers out of the flood zone. So we've done a lot of work, and we have some plans that were funded by the study. It's like one of the future plans is in concept phase is a stormwater pump station. Well, that is probably in the, you know, the $20, $30 million range. So that's probably something that the town can't afford to take on our own, and we need a partner, so to speak, whether it's from the state level or the federal level. And we've, you know, we've gotten good luck getting thus far, so hopefully there's more in those regards.
Joe, I'm curious about something that you said, because when you said the IT center and being in a flood zone, I would figure that or the police station, they would be further inland, closer to the post road.
So one of the things about our beach neighborhood, and we're not trying to change our beach neighborhood. It's a great neighborhood, close to Long Island Sound, close to downtown, close to the train station. And along with that, there are schools, our senior center, our PD, our fire station. They're all located in the flood zone. But, yes, so the critical location, so, you know, our police station, there are no plans to move that. But if you have the 911 dispatchers, yes, it does make sense to relocate them. We're looking into actually bringing them up to SHU. And similarly, you know, the old philosophy with IT was you put them in the basement of the building. Well, having it in the basement in a flood blown is not a good idea. So there are adjustments we are making. So it's a semi retreat, I guess, of the critical facilities. But our beach area has well over 1,000 homes. We don't think those homes are obviously not going anywhere. We just have to find a way to when we get flooding, our goal is to minimize the damage, minimize the public safety, the property damage, the time of the floods, the severity of the floods. So we're going to get them. We just want to be more adaptable to them.
Kevin, this goes back to what you were saying, because when we were putting this program together, my first thought was, okay, we're going to be talking almost strictly about the homeowners. But from what Joe is saying, obviously businesses, critical infrastructure, 911s, emergency calls, IT centers, police stations, if they're anywhere near a flood zone, if they're anywhere near the coastline, you got to move.
Well, you have to certainly adapt, and I'll give you an example. On Eastern Long Island, we're largely on in-ground septic systems. So when you consider coastal inundation, flooding these leaching pits, ultimately you're talking water quality impacts. So over time, some of these areas will have to move into municipal systems where, again, we're getting these out of the ground and where they would be affecting water quality in nearby harbor or bay. It depends on the location and again, vulnerability to flooding and surge. Certainly, Long Island has its fair share of those locations, as does Connecticut, and we've got to adapt, make the necessary changes, and what I feel is ultimately while protecting the integrity of our natural shorelines.
Joe, with the 30 seconds we have left, you all set for the summer? Everything ready to go?
Yes, we are. We're continually making improvements to our drainage system. So we have a lot of plans in the works for the small-scale stuff that we could do within our operating budget. One of our long-reaching goals is, yes, we understand that the beach is there for a reason. It's a lovely beach. Changing it with hard structures sort of defeats the purpose of why people go to the beach for. You want the sand, the sea breezes, the views. So, building,
Joe, I have to hold you there because we're just about out of time. I appreciate your time. Joe Michelangelo, Director of Public Works for Fairfield. Kevin McAllister, Founder, President of Defend H2O. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's it for our show. I'm Ron Ropiak. Thanks to you for being part of The Full Story.